So there's no memory.
Categories.
All right, Booker. All right. Welcome, everyone. We are going to call this meeting to order. This is the Wednesday, March 6, 2013 meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee meeting. Members, we have 10 bills on the agenda, and we're going to try to get through all of them. Obviously, we're not going to be able to get through all of them by 5:30, so we'll break briefly, switch rooms, and reconvene at 6 o'clock in room 112. Upstairs. I know a lot of members have a lot of committee meetings meeting this evening as well as we try to meet first policy committee deadline. So please let Michael or Ted know where you are if we need to come find you. And then members, as you know, our plan this year was to dual track a number of policy items, and so we've voted on a number of individual bills, but we'll also have an omnibus policy bill. The delete all draft of that will be up online tomorrow, so you can take a look at what's in, what's not in, and we'll do markup on Wednesday. Request from Senate Counsel, please have your amendments ready for markup before committee starts, so please try to work with Bonnie and or Krista before the hearing on Wednesday and not during committee, because that's really, really hard for them to do. With that, we will proceed. Folks are going to be dashing around quite a bit, and so we may not take these bills all in the order in which they're listed. We might bounce around depending on who's in the room and who's ready to go, or folks who have traveled need to get on the road, that sort of thing. Did I see your hand, Senator Peterson? Oh, okay. Great. Senator Kent. Agency bill, I think. Senate file 923.
How are you doing?
Welcome to the committee. The quorum is present.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Susan Kent, and I'm here to introduce Senate File 923. It is motor vehicle registration rules, periods, permits, veteran special plates, record retention, and federal compliance modifications, plus a background checks authorization, affectionately known as the Driver and Vehicle Services Housekeeping Bill. Fantastic. And so a lot of this is conformity, getting things kind of cleaned up, tidied up, and with that, I will turn it over to Pat McCormick from Driver and Vehicle Services.
Thank you, Senator Kent. Welcome, Ms. McCormick. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And our DVS policy bill, as Senator Kent just said, for the most part, is just cleanup language. As you know, we're working on the MNLAR system, and as we're working through it, we are finding provisions that no longer apply to the business that we have right now, as well as there are some provisions in here that we need in order to be able to implement some of the laws we currently have on the books that we need some clarifications on. So if it's all right with you, I'll just go section by section.
Perfect.
So, Section 1 and 2 deal with the fact that we're just clarifying that our current vehicle registration practice is to register passenger vehicles for a minimum of 12 consecutive months as opposed to 12 calendar months. And so that's the provision for Section 1 and 2. Section 3 talks about the driveway and transit license. And this is just to clarify that this type of license plate is only valid in Minnesota. Apparently, we found over the last 2 years that people have used these plates throughout the country, and they're only supposed to be able to use them within the state, and we're trying to prevent fraud and misuse, and so that's why we have this clarification in the bill. Section 4 deals with special plates, veterans plates. Several years ago, before we had law changes that related to readability issues for law enforcement, we had stacked letters on a few veterans' plates where the letters are on top of each other. Those are very difficult for law enforcement to be able to read. And so this is just to eliminate that provision. We no longer use those stacked letters, so it's just to make sure we're cleaning up the language and keeping the language as to what we are currently administering. Motor vehicles for certain non-residents is the issue for Section 5. DVS issues a 30-day base plate for out-of-state commercial vehicles in excess of 26,000 pounds that aren't registered in Minnesota. We found that there's specific language that in that statute that talks about limiting owner-operators who own or operate circuses, carnivals, and other amusement attractions, and this has not been used for several years, so we're eliminating that language. Section 6 deals with our prorate international registration and reciprocity provisions, and this defines the fact that a trip permit is issued to a motor carrier who would normally apply for full registration but only needs to come into the state for a special trip. And so what we're defining is that on an occasional basis means it's only one trip permit in a 30-day period. We have found that this would not change current business practices. Section 8 deals with motor vehicle dealers and used vehicle parts dealers specifically, and this just adds this category.
Mr. McCormick, I think that's Section 7.
So I think Section 7 is also with the trip permit, I think. So
6, actually.
I'm sorry, okay.
Let me get the bill out. I've been working on my notes.
Okay.
Make sure I'm not missing something.
Check, 6 was the trip permit. So Section 7.
Okay, that's the, I'm sorry, I just had the wrong, this deals with the used parts dealer, and it's a category that was eliminated in the statutes. We're not quite sure why, but we need that definition and category in the statutes, and so we've added the permissible and prohibited activities for a used parts dealer. The limited use dealer,
Section 8.
Both of those spaces. Oh, the limited use dealer is currently for nonprofit dealers, and this has to do with, it would be like the Courage Center who deals with cars. This is to set up the same types of requirements in order for us to ensure that they're meeting the law when we go in to audit their books, that they have an office, they have files, and those kinds of things. The next section deals with the location change for motor vehicles, and this removes the one-year wait requirement for an applicant whose new dealer license might have been denied. What we're trying to do is to allow them to come into compliance, and once they meet all of our requirements, then we would issue them the new dealer license rather than waiting for a year. Section 10 and 11 deal with report of junked vehicles, and this change reduces the amount of time in which a dealer has to report a junked vehicle transaction to the department from 30 days to 10 days, and the reporting can be done either through our through access to our DVS database, or it can be done through a deputy registrar. Section 12 has to do with driver licensing and training schools, and this requirement has to do with a valid medical examiner's certificate. All commercial drivers are now required to have medical certification, and the federal government requires that medical examiners need to be able to be on the list of the National Registry in order to issue that certification to a commercial driver. So this is just putting us in sync with federal regulations. Section 13, background investigations. These background investigations have to do with us complying with the federal government's rules related to us issuing, our DVS in Minnesota issuing an enhanced driver's license or ID card. Right now, we would need to have all of our staff that issue driver EDLs, enhanced driver's licenses, would have to have a FBI background check. We were not aware of this law when we initially signed our business agreement with the Secretary of Homeland Security, and so we're requesting that we can get permission to get this to get these background checks done so that we can implement EDL law. In addition to that, there's also a federal requirement that requires that commercial drivers, exam staff that test for commercial drivers also be able to have background checks to prevent fraud. And so we need to have a law in place. The FBI will not allow just a rule to be in place. We have to have a statute that allows for the background checks. And that's why we're doing it. We did have it in our rules, but they aren't allowing that, and they're saying we have to have a statute that will allow us to have the FBI background checks. Section 19 and 20 have to do with the information on a license and ID card, and this has to do with an enhanced driver's license. Currently, if you're 65 years or older,
Ms.
you
McCormick,
can get...
I think that's sections 14 and 15.
Yep. I must be looking at a summary before they end the bill. I apologize. The ID cards for seniors are ID cards that once someone turns 65, they don't have to renew their ID card unless they have a change of address. To do that with enhanced driver or enhanced ID cards, because the federal law requires that you have to have a new EDL or EID every 8 years. And so this is a provision that makes that exception. And I think that the expiration, that has to do with the expiration, so that if you're 65 or older, then you would have that exception, and you would have to get one every 8 years. And we also have a provision that requires that once you've gotten an ID card at age 65, then you don't have to pay the current license cost for the card. We have to require it for the enhanced ID card because they're very expensive, and in order to just recover our costs. The final section has to do with a repealer. It repeals a statute that deals with a one-way permit. No one has used this permit for over 20 years, and we thought that we could eliminate that statute.
All right. Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Senator Kent.
That's it for us. If there are any questions, we are here.
Great. Thanks. Questions? Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Chair Dibble. And Pat, I'm sorry, I walked partway through the testimony, but of course I walked in and I heard EDL and right away tuned in. And Senator Kent, that was one of my freshman bills. Be glad you have this one. It's better. So it's not background checks on applicants. It's background checks on employees who are going to be processing applications for EDLs.
Senator Kent or Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Reiner, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
As well as those who are doing the testing for CDLs.
Is that, Mr. Chair, McCormick? Yes, that's correct.
All right.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Further questions, members? We do have Mr. Neumeister has indicated he'd like to testify. Mr. Neumeister.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. If you can focus on Section 13, which is the background investigations, I very much encourage you, at least here, state it publicly and as it goes through the process. First of all, these are probably going to be dealing with at least with 100 or so employees of DPS, probably a lot of long-term type folks. Issues, what happens with background checks sometimes, someone who may have been there a long time, a background check comes back a certain way. It seems like this is a Fed. I don't think there will be any state requirements, but it's Fed requirements. So what happens? Do those employees have due process? That's one item. And what's the process in that regards? And it's not clear here. Number two, it's important that when the information comes back, and this is a situation that happened in another background check bill dealing with FBI records and state records, that people weren't being able to get access to the actual records that were being used against them in a possible disqualifying of a job or whatever. So I'd like that to also be addressed as it continues on its way. So those are just a couple things I wanted to encourage, I think, for a better bill, and at least for those number of employees or even new people that this could have an impact with. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Both good points, and this bill is going to Judiciary. I presume you'll be there, Mr. Neumeister, and
Friday,
Senator
I
Kent heard you. Okay, so
yes.
Great.
Mr.
Sure.
Chair, I just want to also mention that all of our staff have a background check, not an FBI background check, but we all do because of the fact that we're dealing with secure information and also the handling of money. So we do that now, and I'm assuming that I haven't had too many cases where people haven't passed the background check, but there is a due process requirement if someone doesn't pass the background check. So I know we're going to Judiciary, and I'll make sure I have that information for that meeting.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. McCormick. They'll ask, I'm sure. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McCormick, the one-way trip permit, you said no one's applied for one in 20 years. Is that because people just do it without asking for a permit? Or because what I'm understanding is you tow something from outside the state through the state of Minnesota to outside the state. So from Wisconsin to North Dakota, for example, but you need a permit to go through Minnesota. And do people just not ask for the permit anymore, or it's just not happen anymore? What is
Ms.
going
McCormick.
On?
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I'm not quite sure, but I have a feeling it may have to do with, you know, we have the international registration plan that we administer where states go, get plates and they can go, they're registered through that plan and they can go to interstate throughout the United States with that registration. And I think that it's probably more likely that carriers are using the IRP plan, that's what we, the initials, the acronym we call it, versus a one-way trip permit. But I can get more information. I talked to the person that has been administering vehicle services for a number of years, and they just felt that if people just aren't doing business that way, where they just make that occasional trip, and the language is fairly specific that you're just going from one state back to the other state, and I'm not sure that that's what interstate trucking is about in this day and age. So, because you're talking about commercial vehicles here, 26,000 pounds and over.
So. Yeah, Mr. Chairman. I just don't want to repeal something that somebody might need in 2 weeks, you know, so I'm just...
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, we made sure that we checked and there haven't been any for over 20 years, and so we feel that this isn't a practice that's common anymore, so... But I'll try to get... I'll get some information to reassure you.
Well, reassure my author here, because... She's really concerned about it, too, I can tell.
Senator Pratt, did I see your hand?
A co-author.
Oh, I thought you were looking to get my attention. Great. Anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate file, what is this, 923? No. Senator Kent, do you have a motion?
I would like to move, Mr. Chair, the Senate File 923 be referred to Judiciary.
Recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary Committee. Any questions on the Kent motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. So, Senator Champion. Senate File 800.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This is Senate File 800. Just so I can provide a little background information, in 2007, the legislature appropriated $5 million for a pilot project to demonstrate technologies for a new way to finance the construction and maintenance of roads based on the number of miles driven. 600 volunteers from Hennepin County and Wright County participated in the study. Smartphones with GPS were installed in their vehicles. The phones were programmed to submit information to MnDOT. In December of 2010, MnDOT applied to the Department of Administration for a temporary classification of mileage-based user fee data, including vehicle identification data, financial account data, road usage data, and participants' names. The pilot project started in 2011. In the Tennyson warning, participants were informed that the data would not be public via the temporary classification, and if the legislature does not permanently classify the data as not public, then the data will become public on August 1st of this year, which is 2013. And the temporary classification expires, as I mentioned, August 1st, 2013. Section 1 of the bill permanently classifies the data as non-public or private. It allows MnDOT to produce summary reports as long as the participants cannot be identified. And it only allows for law enforcement to access the data pursuant to a valid probable cause search warrant. Section 2 of the bill, last year the legislature authorized construction manager, general contractors, which is a new contracting authority limited to 10 projects, but the data practices portion was inadvertently omitted from the legislation. And so the CM, which is also the construction manager and general contractor, combines the innovation of design bid build. It brings the contractor in on a project earlier and distributes some of the risk. And the language in Section 2 of the bill is similar to existing law for MnDOT's design build data classification. And the bill breaks the process down into events and determines what becomes public after the event. All data becomes public once the project is awarded. Here's the process quickly. MnDOT solicits a request for qualifications. MnDOT announces the short list of qualified construction managers or general contractors, and then the data becomes public. MnDOT solicits a request for proposal. Proposal rankings is completed, and the CM or the GC, which is also the construction manager and general contractor, is announced, and then the data becomes public. Contract negotiations with selected construction managers and general contractors begin, and fully executed contracts or new procurement methods, all data becomes public. I do have a testifier, Mr. Chair, from MnDOT, and if there's any further information he would like to provide, as well as answer any specific questions from the committee, I would solely appreciate his ability to testify.
All right. I'm sorry. You wanted to testify or just answer questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peter Zuniga. I'm with MnDOT's Office of Chief Counsel. I think Senator Champion covered the provisions of the bill. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Zuniga. Questions, members? All right. I see Mr. Neumeister hopping to the table. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Several years ago, there was $5 million spent in a bonding bill to develop basically trying to collect revenue based on how many miles people go. And what they did, they put GPSs in the people's cars and all the places where they went. $5 million is a lot of money. And this idea about mileage, how you get money through the mileage, is an important question to ask. One of the things that, as Senator Champion indicated, Mr. Chairman, is that this went through a temporary classification. It did not, that means that you can go directly, just like the license plate readers, as you are aware, Mr. Chairman. Mayor Ryback went to the admin, hey, we got to make this private, and then it comes back to the legislature. So now, if this went in originally, maybe you as legislators would do the following. The names of the participants in this process are going to be private. I would like to suggest, because of the money that was spent and the unique type of experiment, is that the names of the participants be public so that the people of Minnesota and others can ask these people, hey, what did you, issues here? What did you think about it? Whatever. This is a big thing. And whether or not, what is the future of mileage, getting revenue by how many miles you go based on something you have in your car, I have no idea. But I know it's been talked about on both sides of the legislative parties. So I would like to encourage for that public accountability and transparency, at least the names of participants. And that has happened in many things. Currently under law now with Metro Mobility, names of people who use Metro Mobility are public, because you wanted to make sure that people were using it right to get, so the public can ask feedback about the kind of service. There's other instances in state law like that. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would suggest that on point 1.3, names of participants be not be public, but eliminate that. That's your choice, and maybe if you choose not to do it in this committee, it's up to you.
Mr. Neumeister, I'm glad you told me that the names of people who use Metro Mobility are public. I actually think that's a bad idea.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Council, we need to address that. all right. Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. And this is going to Judiciary, of course, where we deal with a lot of these data practice issues. Questions, members?
Mr. Chairman, yeah.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I don't know if this is for the witness or for the author, but what's the purpose of this bill?
The purpose is to make, at least in the first part of the bill, there was a mileage-based user fee pilot, a study that was done, and people used these little devices and went around just to figure out if the idea worked or not. And that data was classified as not public, private data on a temporary basis. We need to make that data permanent if we don't want, as Mr. Neumeister described, if we don't want to release publicly the names of the folks who participated and, all the places where they drove or how much they drove. And then the second part has to do with at what point in this new concept of construction manager general contractor pilot, at what point is information on the proposals, et cetera, at what point is that private, and at what point is it public, and what information gets made public? An oversight in the development of this particular pilot. Does that make sense?
Well,
or Mr. Zuniga,
it does,
can help
but
us.
Maybe, Mr. Chairman, you can then tell me why we did this in the first place.
Senator Tomasoni?
Checked people to see where people are driving and how they're using the roads. Was the intent to see if we needed more trains, or was the intent to see if we should be taxing people based on how they use the road?
Mr. Chair,
or was it neither of those?
What was the first? More trains?
light rail transit.
Yes, that was the reason, and we decided no more cars, trains for everyone. It was a test of the mileage-based user fee concept, because the gas tax isn't going to pay the freight in the long run for a whole bunch of different reasons. And so it was a pilot just to see if that might be – it was voluntary. It was a pilot. It was a test to see if that might be a viable way to raise revenue as a replacement or in addition to gas tax in the future. So it was just a test. I think it's concluded now. But all that data on the participants and their activities, everything that – all information is presumed public. All government data is presumed public unless it's classified in some other form or fashion as private or confidential. It's either public or not public, and then within the not public category, it's either private or confidential.
And, Mr. Chairman, then the only time that – and the only reason that this bill is here is to make the information private except for when a contract has been awarded, then the information becomes public? Is that
– Well, now you're getting above my pay grade. Mr. Zuniga.
Mr. Chair, members, I think what Section 1 does is it permanently classifies data related to mileage-based user fee. What Section 2 does is it applies to data about our construction manager, general contractor, contracting authority, and it determines all the data that we create during that process. It determines the classification, who has access to it, and determines at what point it becomes public, with all data about that contracting process becoming public when a contract is fully executed.
So there's nothing in here that says that the commissioner shall recommend that we use mileage-based gas taxes or anything like that, right? This is all about the people who just took the survey.
Right. Mr. Chair, members, this only pertains to the pilot study itself. It doesn't apply to any future implementation of a mileage-based user fee.
Senator Sengem, and then Senator Westrum.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps to either witness. I'm trying to sit here and understand if the citizens of Minnesota paid for a study, why wouldn't we, at the conclusion of the study, why would we even hesitate making that public, if that's what I'm understanding here? Why should it be private? Nothing in government's private, virtually.
Especially
a study like this.
Mr. Chair, members, what we are aiming to protect is really the participants' road usage and their identities. Okay. What Section 1 also does, it allows us to create summary reports of the type of road usage, types of vehicles used, as long as individual participants are not identified. So a vast majority of the information will be public through summary reports. What we're really wanting to protect is the individual road usage and the participant names.
Maybe I will ask. I mean, could not that be done by giving them numbers or letters or there must be codes that could be used?
Well, Senator Sengem, that can't happen unless we pass this bill.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's automatically public information.
Yeah, well, you're right. Thank you.
Senator Westrum.
So, Mr. Chair, a little on the line of Senator Sengem, but to his idea, maybe an amendment to indicate that the information should be designated a letter or a number, and then at least there'd be an idea to authenticate that. I mean, one has to presume that everything was tallied right, and but to the question, I guess is similar to Senator Sengem. What? Explain to me who was in this again? How many again? And it'd be like going to Senator Champion's spouse, saying, "Will you join us in this study? Can we put this GPS type system on your car and track you for the next year?" Just so we get an idea how many miles an average person's driving, and then you went across the state into rural areas and metro areas. Is that how this got done? And is that the concern that somebody's been, person X doesn't want the release of where they went, that they went to the movies, that they went to the liquor store, that they went to the grocery store? Is that kind of what we're protecting here? Two parts to the question.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Westrum. Two things. So the first part of your question is who participated. So there are 600 volunteers from Hennepin and Wright counties, and they participated in this study. And you're right about smartphones with GPSs were installed in their vehicles, and the phones were programmed to submit information to MnDOT. And as I mentioned earlier, in December of 2010, MnDOT applied to the Department of Administration for a temporary classification of mileage-based user fee data. And that data included, which is what we are seeking to remain private, is vehicle identification data, financial account data, road usage data, and participants' names. So it's that information that was gleaned as a part of the pilot project that was started, and this pilot project was started in May of 2011. And so this bill, at least Section 1, seeks to permanently classify that data as non-public or private.
And Mr.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, to the MnDOT testifier, well, I remember this. The reason we temporarily classified this private is what? There were some surrounding issues and why we didn't make this permanently classified at the time. Can you refresh us for the committee's memory?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't want to offer any speculation of why the legislature didn't permanently classify it, but I do believe that some people objected to the policy behind the study itself and not the data classification.
Mr. Chair, how would that relate to making it temporary versus permanent? Seems to me there's a con side to this, and maybe Mr. Neumeister hit it, or maybe Mr. Neumeister remembers, because I believe you were probably part of those discussions.
Mr. Zuniga.
Mr. Chair, members, the difference between a permanent classification and temporary classification is a temporary classification is approved by the commissioner of the Department of Administration, and it's only approved for a limited time frame, which in this case is August 1st, 2013. At that time, it's the legislature's job to either permanently classify the data as not public, and if the legislature fails to do so, the data do become public.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Neumeister, are you able to shed some light and recollection of the committee and what surrounded this not actually getting classified in a data privacy bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, like with many things, what happens, it could have, because they started the program and all of a sudden they realized they got to keep this data private, so they go for the temporary classification. Or it could be a mistake or inadvertent, or the department not planning that well when the $5 million went into the transit bonding bill or the transit bill 4 or 5 years ago. So those could be the different scenarios. Now, with the temporary classification coming before this committee and then the judiciary, it's whether or not you as a public policy under transportation, whether or not you want some accountability and transparency on how this study was done, how effective it was done. And that's up to you. So you, either you can go with what they're offering as a temporary classification or to make certain other kinds of data should be public.
And Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator.
Senator Champion.
And I would just like to say again, there's still transparency in the process here, because what it was allowed to happen is MnDOT to produce the summary reports, which is the information that we want, as long as the participants cannot be identified. And so we want to make sure that those individuals, those volunteers who participated, understanding that there was a temporary classification, that their identity was going to remain private, that we continue to honor that agreement, and we are asking you to move this bill forward and pass this law. Because as you know, if we don't, then the temporary classification expires on August 1st, 2013.
Senator Kiffmeyer and then Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Champion, I support the privacy. When lawful citizens are doing lawful activities and because they come into contact with government, doesn't mean their right to privacy is lost. And so you have also situations where people are in, I think, of battered women situations where it's very sensitive as to, again, their lawful activities. But the big thing is this is not a law enforcement issue. They are doing law-abiding activities, and as long as they are doing so, and we have other statutes that allow that if they cross the line and something else is going on, then that right to privacy is lost because of a criminal activity. So my understanding from this bill is that it's private data, personal data, because they're doing lawful activities, and this is not a matter of the public right to know just because it happens to come in contact with government. And this is true, I would believe, with IRS and a variety of other things where you are submitting private data for a particular government purpose, and beyond that, that is it. And so it should be private data. So I just wanted to speak to the issue.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Pratt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Senator Kiffmeyer touched on part of my question, Mr. Zuniga. When I'm assuming these test participants signed agreements, and can you validate that there was an expectation of privacy when they signed these agreements?
Mr. Zuniga.
Mr. Chair, members, we did provide a Tennyson warning to the participants, and in the Tennyson warning, we made it clear that the data was classified as not public under a temporary classification, and we made participants aware that there was a possibility that this data could become public on August 1st, 2013.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If, Mr. Zuniga, if we agree to make this data permanently confidential, is there, kind of to Senator Senjam and Senator Westrum's questions, is there a way to provide detail and information for validation of studies without including personally identifiable information?
Mr. Chair, members,
Mr. Zuniga.
That's what we hope to accomplish by allowing us to produce summary reports on types of vehicle used, the road usage, as long as we can identify individual participants. So if we can say that Mr. Smith left his house at 11:30, drove 2 miles to the grocery store, some of that information would be available through the summary reports. We would prevent the disclosure of certain information that could identify Mr. Smith. So as long as we can ensure that the participants' identities are not ascertainable, the summary data is allowed to be produced under this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for kind of harping on this point. Summary to me means aggregated. What do you mean by summary information?
Mr. Zuniga.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a pretty, I think, broad category. If we do get a request for individual, you know, road usage data, we would have to look through the data and determine if there's any data in there that could be used to identify the participants. And so I think when we're looking at summary data, we're looking at the types of vehicle used. You know, a SUV drove this many miles for this long, and this would be the calculated user fee. So I think when we hear summary reports, I think that's kind of what we're looking for.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 800? Senator Champion, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 800 be recommended to pass and move to, I think, Judiciary.
All right. Any questions on the Champion motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. Thank you. Senator Champion, you're up next with the next bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Senate
Chair.
File 810.
I have before you Senate File 810. Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment that I would like to go through because that would allow the bill to be in the shape that I believe to be appropriate.
All right. That's the A1, Senator Champion?
That is correct. The A1 amendment.
All right. We'll need to pass that around. I don't think it's in our packet, but our bill brief is written to the A1.
And if I might, Mr. Chair, I'd like to go through it so that the
sure,
committee knows
absolutely
exactly what we're doing. I would like for you to look at page 2, lines 6 and 8. Yes. We would like to delete lines 2.6 through 2.8. Then if you also look at page 2, we would like to delete line 2.14. If you also look at page 2, we would like to delete lines 17 and 18, or 2.17 and 2.18.
And then also page 2, delete lines 2.20 to 2.23. And lastly, page 2, delete section 3. Just for a little clarification, that makes sure that we address some of the issues that were articulated, especially when this bill was heard in the House. We think that this these changes are appropriate, and it narrows our focus here, and we would ask that you would pass the amendment, the amendment.
Thank you, Senator Champion. This is the first hearing for this bill in its Committee of Original Jurisdiction. It's an author's amendment, so we will do the courtesy of the author's amendment. All in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes to the bill.
All right. And, Mr. Chair, just to give you just a little background on this particular bill, before my testifiers come before us, what this bill does is, thank you, Mr. Chair, is that this is Metro Transit's agency bill, and it's for various transit programs. It collects a variety of information, or Metro Transit does. It collects a variety of information on transit riders that many assume is private. And since we are a government entity, unless this information is protected as private under Minnesota data practices laws, someone could request and obtain the information. And some of the information, just for clarity, includes things like personal home addresses, emails, travel history, phone numbers, and other data that is not normally deemed public. And so this proposal, or this Senate file that's before you, will classify a variety of information collected for various transit programs as private and cannot be obtained by the public. And this proposed initiative will give the agency liability protection if some of the data would be used inappropriately. And so with that being said, as far as a context, Your Honor, I would like to allow my testifier to present the specifics of the bill.
We're in committee, not court, Senator. And I'm not wearing a robe or a wig. So. You call me
Mr. Chair.
I think we foreshadowed this bill in our last bill. Mr. Shetnan.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and for Senator Champion for carrying this bill for the Council. What I'd like to just address the amendment that was adopted. That language that was removed was recommended by the Department of Administration and their folks and data practices folks, because that language we found out was to be redundant in other areas of statute. So we appreciate the fact that the committee moved that amendment and adopted it. With me today is Tom Randall, who's our senior manager for revenue collection at Metro Transit. He's going to just explain very briefly why we're bringing this forward. And Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments relating to Metro Mobility riders and protecting their information and their identities. That is covered as part of this initiative.
I double-checked Mr. Shetton and I saw that.
So. Yep, so fantastic.
Glad we had that discussion previously. Yep. Mr. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. This initiative would classify individual data gathered via the regional fare collection system and the personalized web services that are related as private to match our customer expectations and peer agency practices. The regional fare collection system used to consist of traditional fare boxes that collect cash and magnetic receipts. Since 2007, we've operated a smart card fare collection system throughout the region, which has availed itself to additional data being collected. The individual transit data will be protected consistently. Individual data collected from fixed route customers now and paratransit customers, those with Metro Mobility and TransitLink, will be protected in the same manner. The data protection provided to Metro Mobility customers will increase. The name would become private, and affords a fixed route customers the same privileges for this personal data protection. We maintain customers' trust for the information that is to be used for transit-related purposes, and the customers will be able to obtain many benefits from this smart card program, as they have a faster boarding, more personalized services, the availability of the web or the phone to add value to their cards and manage their transit purses, et cetera. The regional transit system gains many benefits as well in developing route and service efficiencies and easier administration for many of the issues that we address daily. These benefits for the fair policy as well as our fair product pricing as well. We've researched peer agencies, as I've noted, Miami, Atlanta, Boston, in developing this statute, and we believe it provides the customers with the expected privacy that they deserve for this product. And with that, we could address any questions you may have.
So is it true that as of today, let me ask this question. Is there a temporary classification of this data now so it is public data?
Mr. Chair, members, no, there is not.
Oh, so folks can go. I know that my go-to card, sometimes I've gone back to check if I actually rode the bus and used it a couple days ago, and I can go onto my own account and see where I've used it. And so, right. So everyone can, quick, before we pass this bill, you can see how much I've been riding the bus lately.
Well, you could see.
Just like we were able to track the mayor all around the city of Minneapolis with the automated license plate reader data that was public. Good. Well, I'm glad this bill is before us in that case. Although people can know where I go. That's no big secrets. Any questions, members?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the handout here from the Metropolitan Council, on the third bullet point, it says this proposed initiative would give the agency liability protection if some of this data would be used inappropriately. Could you explain where in the bill or how that is construed?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have Dave Tyson, who works in our council, come up and speak to that section of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Tyson. I'm the Deputy General Counsel for the Metropolitan Council.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think that is specifically outlined in the law. I think the proposed legislation, what we're trying to get at is protecting private information from people who have bad motives. We're trying to protect the people and the private information they have and getting it into the hands of people who would misuse it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. Well, I understand that. I've read the bill. What I don't understand is the statement that you make that the agency would have liability protection. So I'm specifically asking about, and so I think what you said was it really doesn't. So then this statement, because maybe I thought, well, maybe when you did the amendment, something was taken out. So it's not true then? It doesn't give you liability protection?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Tyson.
Is members it of the
Tyson.
Thank you. Members of the committee, I believe that if this legislation were to pass, the Metropolitan Council would have the same liability it would have for every other piece of private data it has in its possession.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And so, Mr. Chair, it is incumbent on the council, if this passes, to protect that information as private and to treat it accordingly.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would absolutely agree with that. I think that is absolutely crucial, and I don't think that just because you're in the government entity and you have a breach and a violation of this that you should ever be exempted from liability for that. I think accountability is very much there, but you might want to take that bullet point off them because that doesn't seem to be quite the case. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Good catch. I had that question myself. Any further questions, members? Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I was here originally for this bill, but as like in many times you go to a committee, things come as a surprise. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm addressing 810 on 2 points. One is if you take a look at Section 1 on lines 110 and 111. Since the late 80s, it has said, with the exception of the name of the applicant or user of the service. When they put that language in the late 80s, it was a legislative policy that we want the names of users of Metro Mobility service available to the public for accountability and transparency. For the public, newspapers or anybody who wants to, can go and talk to them and say, hey, you spend about $60 million every biennium on this program. How is the program treating you? How is it doing independently of the Metropolitan Council. It's also to see whether or not, you know, is there, with people might say, hey, the service is being abused. The legislature, your past folks, made that very clear with the exception. So it's not like all of a sudden, like license plate readers, oh, we just discovered it. It's all public, and we have to rush in to make it private. So I'm just saying with you, it's been a policy since 1987 or 88 on that item for the accountability and transparency. Now subdivision 2. This is a policy that you're going to be dealing with down the line.
It's a transportation policy.
Many transit systems throughout the country are saying, we're not taking cash anymore directly. We're not taking the paper transfers anymore. We're not taking the paper cards. Or they're saying, if you're going to use cash, like in D.C., where I go quite a bit, you have to pay an extra buck or two to use cash rather than a go-to card, which is a smart card or chip card that is used. 100,000 people have those records now
in the metropolitan area. That's
what I heard,
or I got from the Met Council. And with that, they, where they went, what time they went, what bus
they went on, or whatever. I have no problem with that being private.
But the questions
are, is what is the current law that they say is redundant where law enforcement can get access to that data? And the point was, is that if there's other law, or if that's part of it is redundant, can law enforcement get easy access to that? And that's the issue, whether or not that may have to do some more research. But you just recently passed a law that said for where people can go, you need a search warrant. Other entities that are far ahead of us in Minnesota in terms of where they have millions of records on people who use these kinds of cards, like New York or other places, they either have a retention schedule that the data is destroyed after 90 days, 30 days. Mr. Chairman, very similar to your bill that just recently on the floor. And secondly, that they clearly say law enforcement cannot just ask for it willy-nilly. So I would like to suggest, as this bill goes forward, and as you as policymakers, particularly in the area of transportation policy, which I think you have an interesting data policy, you might want to consider that.
So Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, those are my 2 points of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any further questions, members? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 810? Do you have anything further?
Mr. Chair, committee members, one clarification. There is always the possibility of using the go-to card without providing personal information. A customer may go to an outlet store and buy a card like this and not register it with Metro Transit or as part of the regional fare collection system. Use it anonymously, I guess, if you will. They can do that. The registration or the personal information that's provided is at a customer choice to avail themselves to additional services we have via the web, via other processes mm-hmm. as well. So of those, we have about 100,000, my reference, 100,000 unique go-to cards used about each month, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. We don't know how many of those are registered or anonymous or otherwise otherwise utilized. So
that was
just a clarification.
I register my card. All right. Thank you. Did I have a question?
Yes.
Senator Pratt?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Quick question. I guess really two quick questions, and I'll get them in one shot. For those that get their passes through their employers, are those automatically registered, or does the consumer have a choice? And B, I guess kind of to follow up a little bit, what's the purpose of aggregating or keeping that personal information to begin with?
Marshall.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for Randall. Customers that are under employer programs, typically they do we haven't required it in the past. The names are kept for administration purposes, really, for that corporate customer or other customer, as well as for ours, so we can replace a lost card, those types of things. Typically, that's what happens. For the other question, the personal data is rarely used, mostly for customer, as I say, administration or service purposes. The aggregate data is what is used for service planning, boarding, rates, those types of things to increase operational efficiencies. If that answers your question.
Senator Pratt.
But couldn't that aggregation be done without personally identifiable information, such as a card number or some other encrypted individualized?
Right. Mr. Chair, committee members, typically it is done without any personalized identifiable information. The aggregate is compiled based on the rides, the routes, separately from any registration data. It's just not necessary for our purposes at all.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Champion, do you have a motion?
I do. I move, Mr. Chair, that Senate File 810 be recommended to pass and move to the Judiciary Committee.
As amended. Any questions on the Champion motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. All right. Moving along. Senator Ress. Senate File
608. Oh, gosh. I know.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have Senate File 608, which is a department bill from the Department of Public Safety dealing with school bus safety requirements modifications, and just going through the bill quickly. In Section 1, the definition of Type 3 vehicles is changed to clarify that it is changing it from passenger cars, station wagons, vans, and buses to passenger vehicles and buses, and in the statute, those vehicles are classified as Type 3, and there are all kinds of vehicles that are used for school buses, as the chairman well knows, and who's been dealing with this issue for a number of years. And a Type 3 in the statute is a passenger automobile that includes minivans, SUVs, and station wagons, as opposed to a MFSAB, which is a multifunctional school activity bus, or a motor coach is another type, or Type B is a moderate-sized bus that's built on a strip chassis, et cetera. And these are all types of vehicles. And what we're addressing here is the Type 3. So that's in Section 1, defined then at line 2.15. That it will now be passenger vehicles as opposed to saying cars, stations, wagons, station wagons, and vans. And that's so that it can now include the SUVs so that there's no difficulty with that. And then in Section 2, there is the further clarification of the prohibition for a school bus driver to be using a personal cell phone, and it further clarifies that not only may a bus driver, which is current law, not operate a school bus while communicating or otherwise operating a cell phone for personal reasons, but whether it's handheld or hands-free, but he also can't do it when the vehicle is in, or she can't do it when the vehicle is in motion or a part of traffic. So if it's sitting on the corner and it's idling and it's part of the traffic pattern, you still can't use a cell phone. A bus driver can't. And then in Section 3, there is the requirement that given that there is a driver's seat belt on a school bus that the if there is one, that it is properly adjusted and fastened, both the shoulder belt and the lap belt, when a vehicle is so equipped that it shall be worn by the driver. So, for example, if the school bus is equipped with both a shoulder and a lap belt, that there is no option open to the bus driver. If it's there, he or she must use both. If there's only a lap belt, then only a lap belt. But if there is both, they must, it's just a clarification that they must use both. And then Section 4 is just referencing the new definition for Type 3 vehicles. So instead of saying passenger cars and station wagons, we just call it Type 3 vehicles, which we have expanded the definition of, indicating that they can carry fire extinguishers, first aid kits, et cetera. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. The patrol is here if you have any questions.
Thank you. Were you available to provide testimony or just respond to questions?
I'm available for questions, Mr. Chair.
Right. Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Rest. A question I have is on page 3, line 2, and maybe your testifier might be well suited for this, and that is explaining what properly adjusted and fastened seatbelt. What is the definition of that?
Please introduce yourself for the tape. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Lieutenant Brian Rue with the State Patrol Office of Pupil Transportation. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that just means the seatbelt is a safety device that's added to the vehicle. We just want to ensure that it is properly worn so it gets the desired outcome or intent. If it's not properly adjusted or worn, it could cause additional injuries. For instance, if a driver would have the shoulder strap under their arm rather than over the shoulder, or as Senator Rust indicated, only have part of the two straps connected if they were separate.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I just have a broader question about this. There are sometimes short drivers who are height challenged where this type of properly adjusted can actually potentially have a risk for them. And so I'm wondering, since we have a good testifier here, if you could maybe shed some light on that. I've had some constituents raise concerns about that.
Officer, I'm sorry, can you repeat your last name again?
Rue, R-E-U.
R-D, I'm sorry.
R-E-U.
R-E-U, Rue, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are aftermarket devices and even devices from manufacturers that they do sell for that purpose that will adjust where the shoulder strap fits so it can be properly worn by any driver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's it.
Right, thank you. Further questions, members? Senator Wager.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Rue, maybe this was covered earlier, but is there an advisory committee that includes representation from drivers to talk about the issue?
Officer Rue.
Mr. Chair, Senator, what issue are you referring to?
Senator Wager.
Well, cell phone use, the proper use of seat belts, and presumably it's in response to a problem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Office of Pupil Transportation does many outreaches. We do monthly meetings with the School Bus Safety Committee meeting, transportation issues meeting, and our own stakeholders group meetings as well quarterly. And then we do a lot of the school bus drivers training in service annually when requested by carriers.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Rue, so we can presume there's awareness by the groups on this, and would that include the Minnesota School Boards Association?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have proposed this language to MAPT, which is the Minnesota Association of Pupil Transportation. That's the school district-owned side, and the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, and they have expressed no opposition to our language.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rest, I have a question, if I may. I think I heard you explain this, but if we could just clarify, when it says the vehicle is in motion or a part of traffic, or maybe this is a question to council, that obviously means if they're at a stoplight or a stop sign, they can't use their
phone. That's exactly what it means, Mr. Chairman.
But if they're parked against the curb, not moving, what happens in that instance? Can they make a call or not?
As I understand it, the restriction is when they're to be considered part of traffic, so idling, stopped but not parked in a lot or something like that.
So on this, that's the key. Ms. Berezovsky, can you help me?
Mr. Chair.
That is the intent of that would be correct. This is taken out of the texting statute, the wording, 169475. Part of traffic would just be in the traffic lane. So if they were pulled over and stopped idling
in the parking lane, they're okay.
To make a call. That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. That's sufficient. Thanks. Anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify on this bill? Senator Sendrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's really not part of any amended version, but I'm kind of curious, maybe there's some history on lines 3, 4, and 3, 5, where it talks about, type 3 vehicles may carry a fire extinguisher, et cetera, in a trunk as opposed to openly visible, it seems to me, in a bus, which would be seemingly more desirable. That's where you see fire extinguishers usually. Right, and certainly every other aspect of our life within this building, fire extinguishers need to be fairly well visible, although it does talk about a label on a trunk, but I don't know. What's the history to just putting the fire extinguisher in a trunk?
It's just current law that applies to passenger cars and station wagons, and since we're changing the definition of type 3 vehicles to include SUVs, this is just a technical change to the statute. It's not proposing any kind of change to the statute of where those kinds of vehicles may currently carry fire extinguishers and first aid kits. There's no change to the law. We're just renaming the type of vehicle to a type 3 vehicle, which now will include SUVs.
So
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I was thinking of type 3 as a bigger bus.
No, it's an SUV.
No.
All
right.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Sendrum, I held up diagram.
Mr. Chair, Senator West, I'm fine.
The different kinds of vehicles.
Yeah.
All, seven or eight different kinds, and they're in statute, and they're actually the language is part of this bill, but we're just indicating that and clarifying more than anything that a passenger automobile, that's what it is, and it includes SUVs.
All right. Further members.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think rather than characterizing an SUV as a truck, it's a passenger automobile.
Great. Thanks.
Passenger vehicle.
Thanks. All right. Senator Rest, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 608 be recommended to pass.
Sent to the floor. Any questions on the Rest motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no?
No.
Thanks.
Motion passes.
Tears and nerves. I have kids who are home.
You're up again, Senator Rest, Senate File 256.
Mr. Chairman, we had an initial hearing on this bill expanding the requirement for a vehicle to have its lights on 24/7. And there's been discussion since the hearing, and I have the I have an A2 amendment, and I'll also have an A3 amendment.
All right.
But I had amendment. We had amendments, intervening amendments, on that committee. So I think, Mr. Chairman, it's more appropriate that this is not an author's amendment, even though it's a delete everything amendment, and that I explain it.
Great, thanks. We'll have the amendments passed around. The A2. All right, so the A2 is a delete all, and then we'll make the A3 to the A2. Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, the A2 amendment, first of all, includes not just headlamps now, but auxiliary low beam lights, headlamps, or running lights. That was a concern expressed by some that, so we met that, we hope that we met that concern at that point. And then on line 2.8, we provide that the department would not keep a record of any driver for conviction of that rate of this violation, and that for 90 days following the enactment, that their law enforcement officers would only issue a warning. There had been discussion in the previous committee, a meeting about making this a secondary offense, and I got fairly strong objections from the highway safety folks because the bill applies 24/7, and it's the 24 that's important, and so they certainly would want to be able, as a primary action, to be able to stop a car traveling in the middle of the night without its lights on. So, but the bill, it does remain a petty misdemeanor, and I think that addresses those objections. And then, Mr. Chairman, if the A2 amendment is adopted, I have an A3, which responds to concerns raised by the Trucking Association.
Great. Thanks. Senator Osmick has a question on the A2.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could be the Mr. Chairman or to Senator Rest. When we many years ago enacted the seatbelt law, that started as a warning also, correct? It was started, the camel's nose was put under the tent with a warning, and then that turned into secondary, and now it turned into primary, right?
Yes, Mr. Rest. Chairman, but this is, I would say, a very different character. We do not want to limit, for safety's sake, a police officer in the middle of the night from approaching a vehicle that's driving that doesn't have its lights on to stop them and say, you don't have your lights on. And if we made it a secondary offense, that sounds fine during the daytime, but if it was that at night, then the police officer or the state patrol officer would have to wait for the car to be speeding or driving erratically or anything else in order to be able, for safety's sake, to stop them and say, please turn on your light. So it's a different thing. It's not we would never want a vehicle traveling without its lights on in the middle of the night not to be able to be stopped as a primary offense, vastly different from seatbelt stuff. That's my opinion, at least.
All right. Thank you. Any further questions on the A2? All right. Senator Ress has offered the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no?
No.
No. Division.
Motion passes.
Division.
Division. All in favor, raise your hand. I heard more ayes than that. Four. All opposed, raise your hand. All right. Three ayes, four ayes, for loud ayes, and 11 very quiet noes. The motion does not prevail.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't understand why any one of you would not want, in order to save a driver's life, a police officer to be able to stop them in the middle of the night if they didn't have their lights on. I certainly would want a police officer to be able to do that to save my life. But, Mr. Chairman, I have the A3 amendment, which I would offer now.
The A3.
Mr. Chairman, this is an amendment in response to the cautions offered by the Truckers Association, and I would invite their representative to come forward to speak in his behalf.
All right. I see Mr. Hausladen or Ms. Bacchus. Mr. Hausladen.
It's okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Hausladen, president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. I want to thank Senator Rest for the discussion she's had with us. And this is a challenging topic because every time we think we have it figured out, some...
I'm going to interrupt you for one moment, Mr. Hausladen. Members, I'm having the Peterson Amendment, which did go on the bill. It wasn't in your packets passed around, just to remind you of the action that we took at the last meeting. Because we haven't adopted the committee report, it's not yet engrossed to the bill. So having that passed around, that's the A1 amendment, the Peterson amendment, just so you remember the bill in its proper form. Sorry, Mr. Hausladen, please proceed.
Yes, thank you. As I was saying, every time we think we have this rectified, we learn some new information. And as it relates to this bill, the trucking industry operates under a wide variety of federal regulations that passenger cars do not. And the state of Minnesota is part of the Commercial Vehicle Safety Alliance, and they have out-of-service criteria that they use for determining if a vehicle, can operate. And if state law specifies that something must be in place, and it is not, then the vehicle can be stopped, and they can be placed out of service, and that light has to be fixed before it can move forward. So it's our understanding, even though our attempt was to come up with... an amendment that might address that the CVSA directive would still be in force. And so what that means for our members is that they would be cited for a violation, they would be put out of service, and then this violation is entered into a federal database, and that directly affects the trucking company scores under the commercial compliance, safety, and accountability. And so they have scores that are publicly posted, and then shippers use those scores to determine if they're going to do business with a carrier. And in this system, warning stops are treated just like full violations. So you put that all in, and we have some issues that we need to work out.
Mr. Chairman, when I had spoken with those folks earlier, there were two alternatives that they suggested. One was not having them covered at all. And the other was the one, it was the A3 amendment. And I'm perfectly, it was kind of like a toss-up. I'm perfectly happy to have the amendment that excludes them so that they do not get into a trouble with having a warning as bad as a citation. That's not my intent. I thought the A3 amendment was innocuous with that regard, and I'd be willing to. Do you have that language?
So I assume I Senator Rest truckers will have to have their lights on at night, too.
Yes, they have to have their lights on at night, and
right.
We're talking about the daytime.
Right.
Portion of this, and I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if you want, we can just lay the bill over, and then I'll get the language and then come back, unless Ms. Berezovsky can fix it quickly.
I think Ms. Berezovsky has figured out how to redraw the amendment to the existing bill as amended. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senators, I redrafted the A3 amendment to modify the A1 amendment, which I believe
yes.
So it would say the heading would be moves to amend Senate file 256A1 as follows, and then it would be A1 after line 11 insert paragraph E. Law enforcement may issue a warning, but shall not issue a citation to a holder of a commercial driver license who's operating a commercial motor vehicle in violation of paragraph D. Except, no, that doesn't work. I have to fix better than that.
Yeah, you're right.
Who is violating this section? Something like at a time referenced in paragraph D. I'll make it sound better than that, but that, I think that's the intent of the redrawn amendment.
Do committee members understand questions, committee? Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Berzovsky, does that mean that, for instance, if a person is driving their private vehicle, that they may get a citation, and if they're driving the truck, they would not?
Mr. Chairman, I think it depends on the type of license they have. If they're driving a truck as a operator of the truck.
Mr. Chair, Houseland. Senator, I know that Captain Rogotsky from the patrol is here, and he probably could clarify that for us.
Captain. Please proceed. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, could you clarify what portion of it that you wanted me to address?
Senator Carlson, can you repeat your question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Captain Tim Rogotsky, Minnesota State Patrol.
Okay. Captain Rogotsky, that if a person is driving their personal automobile, now, and I don't recall if a commercial driver's license is an endorsement or is it a separate card, but if a person is driving their personal vehicle and is stopped for not having their lights on, they would get a citation, but if they were driving a commercial truck, then they would not get a citation. Is that the way I'm reading this?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct, your assumption on that, and I would see some problems that would conflict with federal regulation on that issue.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Berezovsky, is the amendment to exclude them in proper form?
Yes.
And I wonder, Madam Chair, Ms. Berezovsky, if you would read that again, and then I'll talk about how it fits into then, since we're back to the A1 amendment. I think that accomplished that Senator Peterson had before. It's what's on the bill now.
Madam Chair, the A3 amendment would now, again, is amending A1. And it would read page 1, after line 11, insert paragraph E. Law enforcement may issue a warning but shall not issue a citation to a holder of a commercial driver license who is operating a commercial motor vehicle in violation of this section at all times not specified in paragraph C.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't think that cures it because Mr. Houseladen indicated that even a warning goes on their record and counts as part of their point score. So I don't want that. I want them excluded from the requirement to have display their running lights during the daytime.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I think what the Senator is saying is that any reference to warning would probably not be appropriate because of its conflict with federal regulations, and that somewhere in the bill there just needs to be a reference that this section does not apply to commercial motor vehicles as defined in statute.
Madam Chair, I think that's a much better amendment rather than that the level of specificity.
Yes, Ms. Berezovsky.
Then, Madam Chair, my suggested amendment would be, again, in the same place after 1.11. During or at all times specified, at all times not specified in paragraph C. Commercial motor vehicles are not subject to this section.
Senator Rest?
Yes, that's correct, and Mr. Helfladen supports that amendment.
I believe. Thank you very much. Senator Pratt, question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm just a bit confused now.
Really?
Can you give me the context of where we sit with the proposed amendment and how it fits in with the existing A1, rather than the legalese, but maybe
Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Pratt, what it says with the addition of the new A3 is that commercial truck drivers are not covered by it.
Senator Pratt, does that sound?
It doesn't mean that in the middle of the night, if they're going down the highway without their lights on. State patrol or police officer may stop them, that's current law, and tell them to turn their lights on or issue a citation. They can already do that. We're specifically saying that would not be a requirement even for a warning during daytime hours.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Rest, so commercial trucks don't have to have their lights on. They won't receive a warning, but
that's correct. They'll need to receive a warning or a citation.
But passenger vehicles is what you intend to cover.
That's correct, or non-commercial.
Okay.
Passenger vehicles. The when I look, maybe we can act on that and then address Senator Peterson's amendment from before.
So any further questions on the A3 amendment? Okay. All in favor of the A3 amendment, signal by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. The chair is in doubt, so...
I'll call division.
Thank you, Senator Osmek. Okay. All in favor, please raise your hand. All opposed, please raise your hand. Nine to five, the amendment passes.
So, Madam Chair, with regard to then looking at Senator Peterson's amendment, I actually do think it mirrors what I was trying to do in the A2 amendment. I don't see very much difference, except that I had a section that started provision for giving warnings rather than being able to issue a citation right away. That looks like to me the really only thing in his lines 110 to 111. He added the Demler Amendment. I added it at 2.8 and 2.9 on mine. That is, there can be no record of it. And then I believe he made no changes to the first part of it in terms of the kinds of of lighting that could be done. It was running lights as well.
So at this point, members, are there any other questions on the bill? Senator Pratt.
So if I understand, we're going to take a vote on this or lay it over for omnibus?
What is your preference?
I think Senator Dibble had indicated to be laid over.
I've just got to say I'm opposed to any changes in the law that would require us, primary or secondary offense, to require the running lights or headlights in the daytime hours, if that's what we're still trying to get to, even with the A1 amendment.
It's not a primary offense.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Peterson?
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, so it's your intention that this bill be put into the omnibus bill and it will not be moving separately. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson,
Senator Rest.
If it has any life at all, it would not be as a separate bill.
Senator Osmond.
Madam Chair, I would motion to table the bill, please.
All those in favor of tabling the bill, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rest.
Stan, we just saved it.
As we had said earlier, we may be moving around, and so we will be moving to Senate File 968 and Senator Carlson.
It's nice of
Welcome, Senator Carlson, whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 968, which is an agency bill, and it fixes some of the statute that references flashing red lights that can face forward on vehicles. There is some inconsistency in the statute, and also the State Patrol would like to have it clarified such that only specific vehicles and emergency vehicles can use forward-facing lights. Forward-facing red lights. What it does is get my information here. We have some the need to keep red lights to law enforcement and emergency vehicles under the present law is under the jurisdiction of the Commissioner of Public Safety, and they may authorize any other vehicle to use red lights for on the roadway and for selected circumstances. But there's another statute that states that no locality may, by ordinance or regulation, prohibit the use of red lights. DPS feels that the two statutes are not consistent with each other, not inconsistent with each other, and can certainly be interpreted together. But some private parties who have wished to use red lights on their vehicles have advanced persistent arguments that 169.04 somehow trumps the DPS commissioner's blanket authority of 169.04 to regulate the use of red lights. For this reason, DPS proposes to repeal those portions of 169.04 that deal with red lights so that this argued conflict of laws situation is abolished and the statutes are crystal clear that any mounting of red lights on non-emergency vehicles requires approval by the commissioner of DPS. And I have Officer Nancy Silky here to expand on any or answer any questions that you might have.
Welcome, Major Silky.
Madam Chair, my name is Nancy Silky. I'm a major with the Minnesota State Patrol. The Department of Public Safety appreciates Senator Carlson authoring the bill and the opportunity for the legislature to review this issue on behalf of all the stakeholders at every level of the public safety community. The bill before you is supported by the Department of Public Safety. It is an agency initiative of the Minnesota State Patrol and the Commissioner of Public Safety. The intent of the bill is to address a very important provision for public safety in the emergency response, which is the use of red lights. The purpose of the bill is to establish clarity with existing statutes relating to the authority to use red lights, really with the intent to restrict red lights to emergency vehicles. Before pointing out the pertinent statutes directly tied to the language changes for this bill, I'd like to briefly review a few statutes directly related to emergency vehicles that were provided as handouts. As you know, emergency response is sometimes life-saving to the public that we serve, and it is critical for those that we serve that we are requiring the aid for our response, that the public response to an emergency vehicle certainly impacts our ability to respond quickly and to an emergency, and it impacts the safety of the emergency responders as well. By the very nature of emergency vehicle response, emergency vehicles must have obedience and compliance with respect to the public responding to red lights that are displayed by emergency vehicles. Red lights are designed to immediately get the attention of the public so they are alerted to emergency response. I would just like to refer to the right-of-way statute as a handout, 169.20 subdivision 5, as it really speaks to the requirement for traffic to yield to emergency vehicles. Under subdivision 5, it speaks to upon immediate approach of an authorized emergency vehicle equipped with at least one lighted lamp exhibiting the red light, that the driver of every vehicle shall yield the right-of-way and immediately drive to a position parallel to and as close as possible to the right-hand edge of the curb of the highway, clear of any intersections, and shall stop and remain in this position until the authorized emergency vehicle has passed, except when otherwise directed by a police officer. And it further states how the driver of another vehicle on a one-way roadway shall drive to the closest edge of the curb and stop, such as a freeway where they may be closer to the median side. So the driver who intentionally obstructs an emergency vehicle then, the violation is a misdemeanor, so it's a significant offense. So because of the need to keep the usage of red lights to law enforcement and emergency vehicles under the existing law, Minnesota Statute 169.64, Subdivision 2, cites that only the Commissioner of Public Safety may authorize any other vehicle to mount red lights for usage on the roadway, and only in select circumstances. And so under the Subdivision 2 colored lights, it speaks specifically to, unless otherwise authorized by the Commissioner of Public Safety, no vehicle shall be equipped, nor shall any person drive or move any vehicle or equipment upon the highway with any lamp or device displaying a red light or any colored light other than those required or permitted in this chapter. Further, I'd like to point out under 169.011, Subdivision 3 further defines the authorized emergency vehicles. Subdivision 3, 6 speaks specifically about the Commissioner of Public Safety's ability to designate and grant the authority to an authorized emergency vehicle. And so it further defines what is an authorized emergency vehicle to mean that it's equipped and identified according to law. And it speaks specifically under 6 that a vehicle designated as an authorized emergency vehicle, upon a finding by the Commissioner of Public Safety, that designation of the vehicle is necessary to the preservation of life or property or to the execution of emergency governmental functions. So currently, the process for that to occur includes an application process where the application is submitted to the Commissioner of Public Safety. And note that the designation of the vehicle is necessary for the preservation of life or property or to the execution of emergency government functions is a standard that the commissioner is held to through statute. And so anyone that does make an application is required to provide an affidavit describing how that vehicle will be used so that it is consistent with the expectation. They're also required to describe how the operation of the vehicle is included in emergency operations and response plans for local law enforcement, firefighting, EMS, or emergency management departments. Further, they must provide a letter of endorsement on official stationery from the governmental body that benefits from the service of the vehicle for which the authorization is requested, and they must have that document signed by someone in authority of the governmental body in which there is a follow-up verification process. They then must provide the information related to training and also the insurance certificate saying that that vehicle is operating in the capacity as emergency vehicle. In addition, the applicant provides consent for a criminal background check and pays a fee. Clearly, the application process to the Commissioner of Public Safety is intended to require review and scrutiny, as significant efforts are made to ensure that red lights be strictly limited and controlled by the Commissioner of Public Safety. So even bona fide emergency responders are required to go through all of these provisions. Yet there's another statute under Minnesota Statutes 169.04C, which is this statute related to this bill, which is reflected in this bill, which states that no locality may, by ordinance or regulation, prohibit the use of red lights. DPS feels that the two statutes are not consistent with each other and can certainly be interpreted together, but some private parties who wish to use red lights on non-emergency vehicles have advanced persistent arguments that 169.04 somehow trumps the DPS commissioner's blanket authority of 169.64 to regulate the use of red lights. So currently, those that do operate under the provisions of 169.04 for the processions or oversized loads undergo no application process or review to utilize red lights. So when these vehicles do use red lights, the right-of-way requirements can create driver confusion and uncertainty if drivers are required to stop for escorts just by means of red lights being displayed. So for those reasons, DPS proposes to repeal those portions of 169.04 in the bill, lines 2.5 through 2.11, that deal with red lights so that this argued conflict of laws situation is abolished and the statutes are crystal clear that any mounting of red lights on non-emergency vehicles requires approval by the Commissioner of Public Safety. And so with respect to those that would be impacted by this bill, the changes in the bill would then require amber or yellow lighting for non-emergency vehicles for the escorting of funeral processions, oversized buildings, and heavy equipment. It's our position that the use of flashing amber lights and manual traffic control is sufficient to ensure the safety for the overdimensional loads and adjacent traffic that they encounter, as well as the funeral processions. The existing statute 169.64 allows for funeral home vehicles and licensed protective agents, or LPAs referred to escort a load presenting a vehicular traffic hazard requiring unusual care in approaching, overtaking, or passing, and to use flashing warning lights authorized by 169.59. And so basically, the existing statute does allow provisions that already are in place for these vehicles to use the flashing amber or yellow lights for those situations. Further, under 169.59, it does allow, instead of the pair of lamps that flash simultaneously, which we would refer to as our hazard lights, either one of, they could also, in lieu of that, use one or two strobe lights or rotating beacon lights with amber or yellow lenses to the front and rear of the vehicle. So that already exists in 169.59, that provision, so there would need to be no additional modifications or changes to allow them to operate in that capacity. In addition to the ability to have rotating or strobe yellow or amber lights, I would point out that 169.20, which is the right-of-way statute, further addresses the requirement for drivers to yield to funeral processions. Law enforcement, ambulance operators, fire departments are universally in support of limiting the use of the red lights strictly to emergency vehicles. And so our position has remained unchanged as this has there has been different perceptions, if you will, on interpretations of some of the different provisions of the law. So the Department of Public Safety has consistently opposed the expansion of the use of red lights to anything other than emergency vehicles to guarantee that the public does continue to respect the flashing red light as an emergency requiring their immediate attention and action. So it's our position that the use of flashing amber lights and manual traffic control is sufficient to ensure the safety for the overdimensional load and adjacent traffic. The use of red lights in this manner is not necessary for safety and will undermine the inherent authority of the use of red lights for emergencies and the driver response to red lights responding to emergencies. We feel it's imperative that red lights be reserved for emergency vehicles, and we ask for your support of this bill. Both Assistant Commissioner Danaski or I would be happy to take any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Major Silkey. Members, are there any questions? Senator Sinjo.
Please don't take me wrong, but I'm almost emotional about it. You express a great deal of fondness for red lights, but most of the police cars I see when they're in full regalia, I mean, look like little Las Vegas. I mean, they got every kind of light that you can think of on them, and at least in terms of color. I don't think the patrol would necessarily, and I don't think that's bad, except that, you know, you get 20 of them in a row at a car accident, they get pretty blinding, I think, as people drive by. But maybe just a comment. Well, let me ask you another thing. Does this mean, in my case, my city has a lot of community service officers parking, people that, you know, check parking meters. They're in community police vehicles that are already all set up, you know, red lights, although they're not emergency people. They're community service people that do paperwork on accidents and all kinds of extraneous things that a full officer wouldn't do. It seems to me all these, and including escorting funerals, it seems to me we'd have to change the lighting scheme on these cars if we were, or these community service vehicles, if we were going to adopt this. I suppose one question is, as I wonder what local government thinks about this. It does seem to be somewhat expensive. I'm not sure what we get out of it.
Major Silkey.
Senator Sinjim, I could reply to the, there are numerous different lights and light colors that are on emergency vehicles. I can speak to, for our vehicles, we are all licensed police officers, and there is the multitude of yellow, there's the blue lights, and there are red lights. It's not uncommon for the local law enforcement vehicles to have just what we would refer to as an arrow stick that just has yellow lighting and would be used for the limited allowances that exist for non-police officers. Typically, those vehicles are marked differently, whether it be a community service officer or a reserve, and so they would have limitations if they are not police officers. I can't speak to the local law enforcement vehicles specifically as far as a standard of how they're all their equipment is mounted, but I can say that there are typically multiple options for what would be typically referred to as an arrow stick that is just yellow lighting, and then other light bar equipment that would often be inclusive of red lights and blue lights, and sometimes some side lights that would be inclusive of red and blue. So the intent of this bill would be restrictive to the use of the red lights to be restricted for those that are operating in emergency vehicle capacity.
Other questions, members?
What do we do with the governor's car?
Are there other testifiers? Mr. Patterson? And may I ask you to please introduce yourself and your name and your organization for the record?
My name is Dwight Patterson. I am the CEO of PATS LLC. We are a licensed protective agent here in the state of Minnesota through the Department of Public Safety. I have some additional handouts here. I'd like to, if the pages can.
Someone will be there,
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. I appreciate this opportunity to come before you and testify on this Senate file. By passing this Senate file, it would put a lot of protective agents out of business, as a lot of us, that's all we do is funeral escorts. I want to make some follow-up remarks on to what Major Silkie had stated. Red lights being on non-emergency vehicles. Well, we look as there are, let me back up. There are two statutes, actually three statutes that we operate under, and I believe you have those in your handouts. Minnesota Statute 326.32 designates what a security guard or a private protective agent is. Subdivision 13, it says, clause A, number 3, control, regulate, or direct the flow or movements of the public, whether by vehicle or otherwise, to assure protection of private property. And then if you look at Minnesota Statute 326.338, subdivision 4, clause 4, it states controlling motor traffic on public streets, roads, and highways for the purpose of escorting a funeral procession and oversized loads, or 5, and if you go down to the paragraph on the next page under 5, it says, a person covered by this subdivision may perform the traffic control duties in clause 4 in place of a police officer when a special permit is required, provided that the protective agent is first aid qualified. Now, in the state of Minnesota, in order to get my license, I had to show to the state that I was good character. I had to go through a background check. I had to go through a FBI background check, as do my employees. I had to show that we are good standing with insurance, can maintain the insurance. I'm a little nervous about doing this.
You're doing great.
Thank you. 16904, it gives the protective agent and funeral homes the right to use red lights when doing these funeral processions and extremely large oversized loads. Moving a 22-foot house down the road at 2 o'clock in the morning, when you're using just ambers, the motoring public, they just see ambers. They don't realize that they need to stop because there's an oversized load in the middle of the road. So red lights are used as a tool, just like a doctor uses a stethoscope. And as far as red lights being for emergency vehicles only, well, a tow truck has red lights. They're not identified as an emergency vehicle. School buses use red lights. They're not identified as an emergency vehicle. And we have gone to the Commissioner of Public Safety and asked for a letter for red lights, and Campion and the new commissioner have absolutely refused to give licensed protective agents the letter of authorization. So, and as far as being trumped, I guess, 169.64, which is the prohibited lights, I believe that was passed into law about the 1964 or sometime, whereas 1969, it was statute 169.04 was amended in 2002. Therefore, the 169.04 statute is more recent than the 169.64. I don't believe that just anybody can put on red lights on their vehicles. I think it's only for non-emergency vehicles and licensed protective agents and first responders. I know that when I spent 16 years at Advanced Life Support Ambulance before starting my business, I did apply for a red light application as a first responder and an ambulance crew, and I was granted one. But like I say, passing this bill would jeopardize my company and my employees. And I ask that the senators vote this one down, please.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson.
Thank you. And I'd like to yield some time to one of my colleagues.
Okay. First, Senator Kiffmeyer had a question.
Oh, Madam Chair, I just have a couple questions, but I didn't want to interfere with letting our testifiers who are here first go first.
All right. Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Anybody else who wanted to testify, please come forward. And please introduce yourself and state your name and your organization for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Fitzhenry. I am representing my company, which is Metro Motorcycle Escort, and also I've been asked on behalf of four of the funeral homes and three other escort companies to show up today. Just to give you a little background, I've been doing escorts for 35 years as far as funeral escorts. Originally, my other background is I am still a licensed police officer, although retired, was a police officer for 30 years. Certified motor officer, one of the first in the state. I also trained other motor officers, including some of the state patrol, in how to do escort procedures. Also elected official in my own city, so I know how when we pass laws or delete laws, we have this butterfly effect and how it affects more people than we can imagine. I've been doing escorts since 1978, and where we started is Minneapolis and St. Paul deputized us as special police. The reason they did this is police no longer wanted to be in the business of doing escorts and oversized loads, when in fact we've even had the State Patrol testify before you that they don't want to be in the business of doing escorts and oversized loads. My question then is, if they can do loads with red lights and emergency equipment, why should somebody who is replacing them in the same capacity not be allowed to do that? The other issue, I just heard the major speak that red lights are for emergency vehicles only. Again, we talked about tow trucks that have them. They did something for law enforcement and emergency vehicles. They added blue. Escort companies do not use blue lights. It's very quite clear to somebody, a citizen, when they're coming down the road, when they see red lights displayed only, something's odd about this. It's not a cop. Because you are all aware that there are blue lights, they're very bright, on emergency vehicles, including ambulances and police cars. So to go further, in 1986, we lost our deputization, if you want to call that, through Minneapolis and St. Paul, when we were required to apply for the state license under the Private Detective Board. Under the Private Detective Board in 1986, we then became licensed protective agents. And as Dwight mentioned further, under that statute, we were authorized to control traffic and to do oversized loads in place of police officers. Okay? For the history part, motorcycles were always allowed to have red lights, and in fact were required to have red lights while doing funerals. Where it came up is some cities then were trying to prohibit them, and that's why this statute 16904 came forward. We were part of the group that brought it forward saying, we're getting tired of trying to figure out when we're transitioning cities, whether, let's say we started Minneapolis, authorized red lights, whether if we transitioned Richfield on the way to Fort Snelling or any other city, would we have to switch? We wanted it really clear in the statute to let everybody know that we are authorized red lights for the purpose of doing funerals and oversized escorts. It really was originally on only motorcycles, but later after talking to them and not wanting to drive a motorcycle at minus 32 in the snow, we convinced them that they should also place it on other vehicles due to winter driving. I would ask anybody here to think in their mind, you've been in a procession probably with a funeral, or you've come upon one. What would you think if all of a sudden we went to yellow lights? Would you understand what's coming at you? Would you think, okay, we have a yellow light coming. Is this person coming to repair the street, or are they trying to stop traffic to actually make safe passage for that cartilage? Today, all the escort drivers that I employ are trained. We've gone through emergency driving procedures. We go through constant procedures on state law. We're required to have annual training and to keep it up for our license. The lighting today is more effective than it was before with LEDs. What's nice about LEDs, when we have them on our vehicles, we shut them off, you don't see red lights. So it's not as if our vehicles are going around like police cars all the time. We remove the red lights, we take everything off, so we don't try to give the public the impression we are police officers or emergency vehicles. They're only on while we're executing those duties. With red lights, we have had no accidents with my company, and I assume Dwight's company, for at least 10 years. Prior to that, it was getting scary. Because of the use of the red lights, people have seen them, they understand who we are, and that they must yield to a funeral procession. If she were to continue to read the statute 16920 on yielding, you would also see you have to yield to a funeral procession. I think she did mention that. It is much easier if they understand red light means yield. You will yield to the red light in the funeral procession. I guess looking over the back of 35 years, I really want to know why we're going to go backwards. We've come so far to make this so safe that I don't think any of you have heard of a crash involving an escorted funeral in the metro area when we do over 30 a day in the metro area. And that's no kidding. Most of them going to Fort Snelling. And that. So we've gotten it too safe. We got the public to recognize the red. And our intent is, again, not to say we're an emergency vehicle, but only to escort that cartilage safely. And even in the statute, as you mentioned, the red lights are to, what, protect life and preserve it, Nat? Aren't we doing that by escorting that funeral cartilage safely through the area? So I would ask, I don't know the purpose of this, but if the intent, because I wasn't comfortable with funeral homes who may be untrained, having the permission of just putting red lights on that, if the intent is to really put it down to people who are responsible and know what they're doing, I would suggest that they suggest that the protective agents under statute 326.338, where it says persons engaged as private detectives and protective agents, be allowed in this statute to continue to use red lights as they were in the past. And I guess That's all I have to say. I'm available for questions if you have it. I have a lot of experience if you've got any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Henry. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it is really important that we actually have red lights in this situation. People are grieving. They are driving and grieving. And they need protection when they're on the roads, and a red light does that. And I think that especially in those situations, it is really important. It's important to have the consistency of this statewide, because then people, no matter where they are, and many times you're traveling in different places for funerals or these sorts of things, and I just think that it's really important to actually have that. I think I know the difference between the blue and red and the flash and the, you know, when you have a string of cars in a procession, red lights, very, very different. But I think it's really important to keep this law as it is, and especially important in those particular circumstances of a funeral procession.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. And very quickly, I just wanted to add as a point of clarification from the previous testifiers, Major Silkey or Senator Carlson, if emergency vehicles are escorting these same types of processions or oversized loads, would they be using red lights in those cases or not?
Madam Chair,
Senator
Major Silkey has a list of points to make, and I think what I'll do is I'll just turn it over to her to go through all the points and also answer your question.
Thank you. And then I know Senator Tomasoni has a question as well.
So. I don't have a question. Should I just make a comment before, so she can refute this one?
Yes, thank okay. you. If so, Senator Tomasoni can make a quick
well, Ms. comment. Well, Madam Chair, I don't think I know of anybody who's ever been confused by whether or not it was a parade or a funeral by the color of the lights that were flashing. So I really don't think this bill is necessary.
Thank you, Senator. Major Silkey, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could just speak to some of the items that were discussed here with additional testimony. I am actually familiar with the statutes that both Mr. Patterson and Mr. Fitzhenry presented here, and I would cite that that's exactly why we're here, though I respectfully disagree with their interpretations and opinions on several of those talking points as well. They had cited as far as some other provisions relating to tow trucks. Actually, there are provisions under the controlled access violations that does allow a tow truck when responding to a crash scene to use the no U-turn crossover and to perform in the capacity of an emergency vehicle. So there are specific provisions to that, and also the tow trucks are included in the move over law where they are considered as an emergency vehicle. There is specific statutory language to address that. Further, in regards to the school bus stop arm violations, again, there's statute specific to the stop arm that does have the red lights with a stop signal that does exist. We have experienced numerous occasions where we do receive driving complaints from citizens. As short as 2 weeks ago, I was driving here to the Capitol, and I overheard a call where a citizen called in. I don't have the audio. That component isn't public, but I do have the transcription of that, where a driver called in and expressing confusion that the motorcycle was driving down the freeway with the red light and waving people over, and there were 60 cars confused, and they didn't know, are they supposed to pull over? Are they supposed to stop? Is it an emergency? What was it? And they had called in to complain to ask us to address their concern. And so it's not an uncommon concern expressed by the public where they have expressed that there is confusion and there is not clarity on how they're supposed to respond. They believe they're supposed to pull over and stop, yet oftentimes the procession is in the right lane, in the slower moving lane, and so then it creates confusion on what are they supposed to do, and if someone's waving to them, they're not clear on how they should act. And in addition, Mr. Fitzhenry had cited as far as they replace law enforcement. I would just cite that there are numerous statutes that address that as far as roles and what the capacity of each role is. The licensed protective agent does not serve in the same capacity as a police officer, and there are statutory requirements that do articulate the limitations of both roles. I would speak to 169.02, which specifically speaks to scope of the chapter of 169. And in that, there is no penalty for not complying with a licensed protective agent that's escorting a load with the yellow lights. Specifically, there's no statutory requirement for the motoring public to yield to an LPA vehicle, even if red lights were permitted, where the statute is restrictive to that, where that is in our understanding and the reason we are here today, actually. We have had numerous occasions where there has been, if the LPA is operating in their capacity and escorting a load, there is not an ability for them to cross over the center line and force oncoming traffic onto the roadway, which has been an experience that we've had on numerous occasions where we believe that there is an exceeding of their limitations, and that to force oncoming traffic to move over using the yellow lights, or even if there were an allowance for red lights, that there is no statutory requirement for the motoring public to yield in that capacity. And so that further creates the DOT actually makes those decisions. When a permit is applied for, our agency is not involved in that. The Department of Transportation takes all applications for any oversized loads, and through their criteria, they make a determination on what the appropriate escort requirements are. Oftentimes, law enforcement is not required. On occasion, depending on the size of the load, the width of the load, if it's going to encroach into oncoming traffic, they do provide requirements in their permit where it requires it be law enforcement. So in those situations, law enforcement is required, and that is done through an authority separate from our agency. Also, I would cite that.
Excuse me, and would law enforcement use red lights in those instances?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We would operate with emergency vehicle lighting for those escorts as well. I would also like to cite, Madam Chair and members of the committee, clearly 169.06 specifically speaks to the obedience to traffic controls and the flagger. And I would just like to further state that under subdivision 4F, an over-dimensional load escort driver with a certificate issued while acting as a flagger escorting a legal over-dimensional load may stop vehicles and hold vehicles in place until it is safe for the vehicles to proceed. A person operating a motor vehicle that has been stopped by an escort driver acting as a flagger may proceed only by instruction by the flagger or a police officer. So certainly there is a place, and certainly the LPAs serve a valuable role in that capacity, but I would also further state that the authority is limited to stop and hold. It is not applicable to moving or being in transport, and there isn't the authority granted through the requirement to yield for any LPA in those situations. So I would just cite the limited scope for that purpose. And clearly, 169.04, the statute that has revisions that's proposed for you, specifically states language in the first paragraph, A, specific to limitations. You could interpret that possibly, you know, the population of 500,000 or more, and the more than 600 square miles. It's almost as though we're trying to defend a negative that may exist. And so that section of the statute, I would say, is designed and lended more towards the metro. And clearly this statute change is specifically related to A3, which is regulating or prohibiting processions or assemblages on the highways. And, Madam Chair, one of the other discussion points was the vehicle lighting. And I would just state that there are restrictions for many purposes as far as which colored lights and what that might mean. So again, there's limited confusion, and so certainly there are restrictions in relation to the blue lights. So blue lights can be used on emergency vehicles, but otherwise they're prohibited except for maintenance equipment and snow removal equipment operated under contract to the state or a political subdivision. And so really, in summary, Madam Chair, we certainly have a difference of opinion as far as those that are testifying, but it remains our position that we believe the use of the yellow or amber lights and the manual traffic control is sufficient to ensure the safety for the overdimensional loads or the funeral processions as referred to in this statute, and that the red lights, we would not want to undermine the authority or the use of the red lights for emergencies and the driver response to the red lights, as it's critical, their response to emergencies.
Thank you, Major. Okay, and just a quick call of attention to the time. But I know we have a few questions lined up, so start with Senator Miller, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Silkey. The scenario that you mentioned where the motorcycle was directing people to pull over, what was that, a funeral, or what was the scenario for that?
Madam Chair, Senator Miller, that was a funeral procession, and there were red lights displayed on the motorcycle used for that procession. That's correct.
Okay, and Madam Chair, just a follow-up.
Senator Miller.
So in your opinion, whether those are red lights or yellow lights, if they were to have been yellow lights, do you think that would take care of the confusing phone calls? I guess if someone's riding along telling me to pull over, whether they're red or yellow lights, I'm going to pull over, but... I don't know what the color of the light would matter in that circumstance.
Major.
Senator Miller, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe that it's a universal response for all drivers. If they see a red light, that they immediately assess that that's an emergency vehicle approaching. And we would not want to minimize the reaction for the public to always move to the right and make way for the emergency responding vehicle. So we do decipher that there would be a difference as far as how the public interprets the lighting, whether it be amber or red, and feel that the amber would still allow protections for the escorts in the capacity as described and for the funeral processions as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Weir.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I would offer that opponents and proponents of very adequately made their case, and we're ready to vote.
All right. Then, Senator Carlson, would you like to make a motion?
Madam Chair and Committee, I move Senate File
968.
968, recommended to pass, and I believe we're going to hold it for. We're going to hold it for possible inclusion.
Move
to the floor. Okay. Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 968 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
All right. On Senator Carlson's motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No.
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 The motion does not pass.
Red light.
Thank you, Senator, and testifiers. And now, at this point, we will take a recess and reconvene at 6 o'clock in room 112 for the rest of the bills on the agenda.
Let me put you down.